Thank you, Matthew. We will now go into the study of Zechariah chapter 14 with Brother Harold.
Thank you, Brother Gordon, and good evening, brothers and sisters, young people, and friends. I'd just like to say the hymns that were chosen tonight were very appropriate, and thank you very much. I didn't do that because I don't know anything about doing that, but the organist did a very good job of selecting the hymns for the topic. So we'll start off with a review. Last month, you may recall that we looked at Zechariah 13 and the first five verses of Zechariah 14. And this brought us to the point in God's pre-recorded history of the earth and with mankind, to the time when Jesus Christ and his recently glorified saints arrived together at the Mount of Olives. We told you from Scripture how they would come from Mount Sinai, the probable place of judgment, and they would arrive at the Mount of Olives. We emphasize the fact that you and I, hopefully, will be very much involved with creating this earthquake that we read about in Zechariah chapter 14. And these are verses in verse 4 and 5, which are closely related to the verses in Acts chapter 1 and verses 11 and 12, which also said, "Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? The same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven. Then returned they unto Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is from Jerusalem a Sabbath day's journey." Now the question we should be asking is, what does "like manner" mean? Well, this phrase comes from the Greek word trophos, which means a turn, that is, by implication, mode or style. So this verse does not require that Christ descend from heaven directly to the Mount of Olives. It simply is saying people saw him leave from the Mount of Olives, and the general population of the earth one day will know that he is back when there's an earthquake and the Mount of Olives is split. And there he will be. He will be back. And where does he come from? Well, it's revealed to us in Zechariah 9 and verse 14 that he comes somewhere from the south part of Jerusalem, or south of Jerusalem. Zechariah 9:14 says, "And the Lord God shall blow the trumpet and shall go with whirlwinds of the south." Now, when we looked at Zechariah 9, we concluded that you and I, hopefully, will be those whirlwinds from the south. And we will be with Christ when he arrives at the Mount of Olives. Other verses that support this concept that Christ arrives at the Mount of Olives with his glorified saints, there's a number of them which you might find interesting. One is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 13. Where it says, "To the end, he may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before God, even our Father, at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ with all his saints." 1 Thessalonians 4:14, "For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, Even so, them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. And Jude 14, and Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints. Well, that was part of the review, at least part of what we looked at last week, or last month. We're told in Zechariah 14, as we read in verses 12 to 15 tonight, that surviving Jews will be required to flee from the earthquake. The mighty power of God will then be poured out in judgment upon the enemy occupying forces in Jerusalem. And then in those verses I just mentioned, there will be this rallying together of Jewish survivors. They will have fled from the earthquake in verse 5, and then in verse 13, they'll be rallied together, and they'll become part of the army of God, used by Christ to help rout any remaining enemy forces. So let's just read those few verses again, Zechariah 14, to see what the Jews are going to do. Verses 12 to 15. And this shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. And it shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult from the Lord shall be among them, and they shall lay hold every one of the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. And this is a Jewish army, and Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem. And the wealth of the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in great abundance. And so shall be the plague of the horse, the mule, the camel, the ass, the beast, that shall be in these tents as this plague. So this plague, this power of God acting upon the occupying enemy force, it's the same sort of consuming power that you could compare to a nuclear weapon. But fortunately, it can be controlled. And that's what will happen, because it will have no effect on the repentant surviving Jews. And they will then become this army for God. So Zechariah 14, verses 12 to 15, are verses describing the final details concerning the demise of the Gogian host of Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. Now, we looked at all of those details when we considered Zechariah 12 and 13, and there's no real need for us to repeat them tonight. So that was a review of basically what we did about a month ago. And it brings us to our topic for tonight, which is in three parts. First of all, we would like to look at the concept of you and me becoming immortal. And that's described in verses 6 and 7 of this chapter. And secondly, we want to look at the proposed changes to the landscape of Israel, verses 4 to 11. And thirdly, we will consider aspects of worship in the kingdom age, as outlined in the last few verses of this chapter, 16 to 21. So on your handout sheet, and if you didn't get one, I'm sure the doorman has lots of them, and there's a few up here as well. On your handout sheet, the first section is entitled, The Glory of the Multitudinous Christ Can Be Subdued or Contracted. And that's verses 6 and 7. Verse 6 and 7. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. Now, when I read those verses, I was quite confused. And I think possibly unless you're unusually bright, you would be as well. These are two verses which are relatively difficult to understand. And you know that right away when you look at the margin, because in the margin there are four alternate renderings in the King James Version given for various words, which suggests that when the scholars were trying to translate this into our English language, they found it very difficult to translate, so they came up with what they came up with, and we find that difficult to translate as well. But let's give it a try. First of all, if you look in both of those verses, 6 and 7, we have the word day. And the word day, we would call it a very elastic word. It's from the Hebrew word yom, and it can mean a 24-hour day. But it can also mean an age of many years of time. And I would suggest that in verse 6 and 7, the word day refers to that extended period of time, not just a 24-hour day, but an extended period of time which begins when Jesus Christ and the glorified saints arrive at Jerusalem. The other word to consider in verses 6 and 7 is the word light. It's also, well, there's a better translation, I think, of this verse in the American Standard Version, which I have put on the screen now. And this is what it says there. You notice that in this version, the light is described as belonging to the glorified saints. And it's quite different in translation. It shall come to pass in that day that there shall not be light, the bright ones shall withdraw themselves. And it's suggesting that you and I could be those bright ones. Verse 7, but it shall be one day which is known unto Jehovah, not day and not night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light. So here's a suggestion of what these verses mean. You and I will be the bright ones of this verse. And it's sort of an unusual thing to think of yourself as a bright one, but we will be endowed with power equal unto the angels. And it can be a consuming power equal, as we suggested, to a nuclear weapon. But notice the bright ones will be able to withdraw themselves. That is, we will have that ability to turn down the consuming effect of God's power. That power can be restrained. I think another version uses that word. The power can be restrained to protect. Protect whom? Well, vulnerable mortals. There'll be thousands of vulnerable mortals who can be destroyed by this consuming power of God. And so this power will have to be reduced in the kingdom age when mortals are present. But when the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, is dedicated, that power, the glory that will belong to the saints, will not be reduced. We're told that we will also be the kings of the east, as well as bright ones, will be the kings of the east, the 144,000, the great multitude that no man can number. That's what our prospect is. And if you look at Ezekiel 43, if you'd like to turn there, to verses 1 to 5, we read about the dedication of this temple that is described by Ezekiel. Ezekiel 43, verse 1, afterward he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh towards the east. Behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. And his voice was like a noise of many waters. and the earth shined with his glory. Now you read that language there is speaking of a multitude of glorified saints coming from the east, the kings of the east, if you will. Verse 4, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate whose prospect is towards the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. So that dedication ceremony will mark the beginning of the 1,000 years of peace on the earth. This is when it will start. There'll be a preliminary period of setting the world straight before the kingdom will begin. But this dedication ceremony begins 1,000 years. And you notice on this overhead, there's a reference to the word evening. Now, in the Jewish way of thinking, the evening is the beginning. The beginning of the day starts after 6 o'clock. And this is the beginning of the 1,000 years, when the glory of the glorified saints, that you and I will not be restrained during this dedication ceremony. And this will mean that mortals will have to be restricted to a certain part of the temple city for their own well-being. And that's okay, because the way that the temple will be used is in an organized way, so that the glory can be there without being a destructive glory. And as we've mentioned, restrained or covered glory will occur throughout the 1,000-year reign of Christ, whenever mortals are present. But, you know, at the end of the 1,000 years, what have we got? We will have no mortality. Instead of being evening time, it will now be morning time in Jewish way of thinking. It will be the end of the day of the millennium period, and then the glory will be allowed to shine without any restraint. Because as the Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 28, God will be all in all, and then the earth will be filled with his glory. With those ideas in mind, let's read this verse again. And it shall come to pass in that day that there shall not be light. The bright ones shall withdraw themselves. But it shall be one day, which is known unto Jehovah, not day and not night. But it shall come to pass that evening time there shall be light. Now, let's have a look at the second part of our consideration of Zechariah 14, the geography of Jerusalem is to be changed. We've already considered verses 4 and 5 of this chapter 14 last month. And you remember that a great valley was to be created as a result of this earthquake. And we read how half of the Mount of Olives would be moved to the north and half would be moved to the south. And then, connected with that, verse 10 comes into the picture. So let's just read verse 10, because verse 10 and verse 4 seem to fit together. All the land shall be turned as a plain, from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, from Benjamin's gate onto the place of the first gate, onto the corner gate, and from the Tower of Hananel onto the king's wine presses. Now, we know that Jerusalem here is being discussed. And we know that because of all those gates and the Tower of Hananel. It's all got to do with Jerusalem. Therefore, it's Jerusalem that is going to be lifted up or elevated. Now, there are at least two psalms that tell us that Jerusalem will become a prominent landmark in the land. And at least two psalms, these two psalms I picked out, Psalm 68, verse 15. The hill of God is as the hill of Bashan, and high hill as the hill of Bashan. Verse 16, why leap ye, ye high hills? This is the hill which God desireth to dwell in. It's almost as if the psalmist is saying, you hills over there, don't try to get as high as the hill that God has picked out. Yea, the Lord will dwell in it forever. They that trust in the Lord shall be as Mount Zion, which cannot be removed, but abideth forever. Now, to translate those two psalms into 21st century terms, we know that the place called Bashan, was called Bashan in ancient times, is now known as the Golan Heights. And currently, the Golan Heights is 3,000 feet above sea level. Jerusalem is just over 2,500 feet above sea level. So Jerusalem, for it to reach the elevation of the Golan Heights, has to rise straight up 500 feet approximately. Now this is the reason why Jerusalem cannot become part of this plain of verse 10. It has to be lifted up to be equal to Bashan or the Golan Heights. Another reason why it cannot become part of the plain is because of the alleged four protective faults surrounding Jerusalem. People that know claim that there are faults surrounding Jerusalem. And although during the earthquake, as we're told in Matthew 24, the remnants of Herod's temple will be thrown down. And that will happen during the earthquake. Mount Zion itself will remain intact, even though it will be lifted up. It cannot be removed, but it abides forever, as we see from Psalm 125. Zechariah 14:10, all the land shall be turned as a plain from Geber to Rimmon. Now you won't find those names easily on maps. But the Geber that is being discussed here is the Geber that is was some 6 miles north of Jerusalem. And the Rimmon was 33 miles southwest of Jerusalem. So if you think about that, that's a lot of land that was a mountain is now going to become a plain. And there will be Jerusalem elevated to an elevation of 3,000 feet above sea level in the midst of this plain. There's another prophecy which outlines similar dimensions to that, and that's in Ezekiel 45. It describes there in verses 1 to 6 something called the Holy Oblation, and that is a place of accommodation for those who will serve in a temple yet to be built. That reserved area, the Holy Oblation, is approximately 50 miles square. Just a little bit larger than that area that is encompassed from Geber to Rimmon. And we'll show you that on this next overhead, the Holy Oblation. Now, there's a couple of things on this overhead. One is a map of Israel showing the allotment to the 12 tribes. And the Holy Oblation is there near Jerusalem. Then in the enlargement, we have the Holy Oblation. And you'll notice on that picture two things. One is that Jerusalem is somewhere close to the center of this square area. It's called the sanctuary or Jerusalem, the temple city. And also on that map, you'll notice the Dead Sea is shown. The Dead Sea in the bottom right-hand corner, most of the Dead Sea, is in the Holy Oblation area. This is all found in Ezekiel chapter 45, verses 1 to 6. Now, in Zechariah 14, verse 8, we talks about the Dead Sea, and we'll just read that now, just because it's on the map. And it shall come, it shall be in that day, that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them towards the former sea, and half of them towards the hinder sea, in summer and in winter shall it be. Before we go any further, you notice summer and winter? A lot of people think, well, we won't have any cold weather in the kingdom. But here it is. It talks about summer and winter, indicating we'll have all four seasons. There'll be seeds to be sown, and there'll be crops to be grown and harvested. But it also tells us that there's a constant stream of water coming from Jerusalem. In fact, the stream is to become two streams, one designated to heal the Dead Sea and the other to flow into the Mediterranean. In verse 8, the word former sea is the Dead Sea because it's in front of the temple, and the hinder sea is the Mediterranean. In fact, in some versions it talks about east and west seas. As a matter of interest, again, the salt content of the Mediterranean Sea is about 3.5% salt. You know, the Dead Sea has got 10 times that amount of salt in it in concentration, varying from about 30 to 35%, making it unsuitable for fish. And that's relative because of what we're going to tell you in a minute, and what we will read in the Bible. This is off the internet. The flora and fauna of the Dead Sea. The sea is called dead because of its high salinity, means no fish or macroscopic aquatic organisms can live in it, though minuscule quantities of bacteria and microbial fungi are present. In times of flood, the salt content of the Dead Sea can drop from its usual 35% salinity to 30% or lower. On average, seawater in the world's oceans has a salinity of 3.5%. Now we're going to take a look at Ezekiel chapter 47 to see where these two streams that we mentioned will go that are coming from Jerusalem. And look at the healing powers that they have. Ezekiel 47 and verses 1, 8 to 10, which you may as well look up if you want, because this will be on the overhead for just a couple of seconds, and then we're going to put something else on there. Ezekiel 47, verse 1, and the waters, the end of the verse, came down from under the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. Then said he unto me, in verse 8 of Ezekiel 47, these waters issue out towards the east country and go down into the desert and go into the sea, which being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed. Verse 9, and it shall come to pass that everything that liveth, which moveth, whithersoever the rivers shall come, shall live, and there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come thither. For they shall be healed, and everything shall live, whither the river cometh. Verse 10, and it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it from En-Gedi even unto En-Gleim, and they shall be a place to spread forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, which is the Mediterranean Sea, exceeding many. So let's now have a look at the sketch map of that situation that we just read about. On this map, we have Tyre and Sidon shown. We have the Sea of Galilee, which is currently 635 feet below sea level, and the Dead Sea, which is 1,300 feet below sea level. And from Zechariah 14, verse 8, we read of two streams, one going to the Dead Sea and one going to the Mediterranean. Ezekiel 47 and verse 9 says, there are two rivers, both flowing east. Both flowing east. But one sea is supposed to go to the Mediterranean. And one is supposed to flush out the Dead Sea. But both are flowing east, rather than one going east and one going west. Well, there's several problems besides that problem to consider. The first is that the Dead Sea is impossible to flush out because it's the lowest point on earth, being 1,300 feet below sea level. I guess it's the lowest point on the surface of the earth, if you don't consider the center of the earth, but it's the lowest point on the surface of the earth. You can't flush it out. And besides, there's no river flowing out of the Dead Sea. So the earthquake of Zechariah 14, verse 4, will do a little landscaping. And in a nutshell, the earthquake will raise the Dead Sea, and it will raise the Jordan River well above the Mediterranean sea level. And the Dead Sea will empty into the Jordan River, as it's shown on this little sketch. And then it will flow eventually north and then west into the Mediterranean Sea. And the Dead Sea will then receive water, at least fish, from the waters of the Mediterranean. So that's how this prophecy of Ezekiel and Zechariah are going to fit together. The living water from Jerusalem will heal the Dead Sea prior to it moving north and then west into the Mediterranean. And the fish of the Mediterranean will swim up the stream, as we read in Ezekiel 47 and verse 10. Their kinds of fish will be the kinds that are found in the Mediterranean. They'll now be found in the Dead Sea. But it will also fulfill another prophecy, which is found in Matthew chapter 11 and verse 21. A rather strange place to find a prophecy. But Matthew 11 and verse 21 to 23. And this is Christ speaking, "Woe unto thee, Chorazin! Woe unto thee, Bethsaida!" Now you can see these places. We've got them numbered 1, 2, 3 there on the map. "For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you. And thou, Capernaum, which are exalted into heaven, unto heaven shalt be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which have been done in thee had been done in Sodom, they would have remained unto this day. But I say unto you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom than in the day of judgment than for thee." So as a result of these physical changes that we've suggested will happen, the cities of Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum will all be destroyed as prophesied by Jesus Christ because of the upheaval of the land, or they will be buried in water. They'll be flooded out and destroyed in that manner. And on the other hand, the cities of Tyre and Sidon, which the water, the healing water, will flow close to one or the other of these cities, or in between possibly, we're not quite sure where it will go, but into that area somewhere, and they will be blessed because of this living water. Well, that takes care of the two sections we are going to look at tonight. Now we'll come to the third section, which is worship in the kingdom age, and it's dealing with the verses from Zechariah 14, verses 16 to 21. And we'll just read verse 16. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So ask yourself a question. When do you think the mortals of the world will go up to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, if we knew what it was, well, that would be good, but the answer is really dependent upon the weather. Now, for mortals living in Israel, this Feast of Tabernacles takes place in September and October, or their month called Tishri. This Feast of Tabernacles is also called the Feast of Ingathering, and there's the clue to when it will happen. It's at the conclusion of the gathering of various bits of produce, including the dates and the figs and the olives that grow in Israel. So after that harvest is finished, that's when the Feast of Tabernacles takes place. However, if you're a person living in Prince George, for example, where I understand my grandchildren's other grandfather is currently running around with a skidoo, the ingathering of crops would be sooner than September and October. It might even be in August. And if you live in Australia, where everything is upside down there and backwards, the ingathering of crops could be March or April, possibly even February. Strange time to be gathering crops. But this is an indication of when the Feast of Tabernacles will occur. It will occur at different times of the year in different countries, because the harvest times around the globe vary from region to region. And there's a very good verse in Isaiah that tells us about this region to region and different times of the year when people will go on a pilgrimage. It's in Isaiah 66 and verse 23. There'll be year-round pilgrimages. Notice what these verses say. This verse, 23 of Isaiah 66, it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another. So there's once every month. And from one Sabbath to another, that's every week, there'll be a different group of people, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. So it'll be year-round Feast of Tabernacles, as far as I can see. Now, can you imagine anyone saying, well, I don't think I want to go, so I'm going to stay home? I can think of the odd member of this ecclesia who has said some words similar to that, where he didn't want to go. But this won't be the case, I'm sure, in the time of the kingdom age. Looking at verses 17 to 19, this is what happens to people that say, I don't want to go. And it shall be that whosoever will not come up, this is Zechariah 14:17. Of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, there shall be the plague, wherewith the Lord will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And this shall be the punishment of Egypt, and the punishment of the nations, all the nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, it seems incomprehensible when you think about it that anybody would want to choose to disobey God, especially in the kingdom age, because the king who is currently on the throne is immortal, and we're saying we're not going to do it. He's immortal, and people, could they say that? The government all around the world will be made up of immortal people. That probably will be you. So why would any mortal want to break the law of the government that is beneficial to the people and is free from corruption. There's never been such a government in the earth. But there will be people like that, and the reason why there will be people like that is because of the deceitfulness of flesh. We read in Isaiah 26 and verse 10, it says this, "Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness," even though he gets favor. "In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly, and will not behold the majesty of the Lord." So flesh is still flesh, isn't it? Even in the kingdom age. Even though organized false religion will be a thing of the past, there won't be any false religion churches over there or over there or anywhere. It'll be a thing of the past. People are still people. And there will still be some who will be sympathetic to the cause of those who at one time will have made war with the Lamb. Revelation 17:14, we're told that there'll be an ecclesiastical power that will make war with the Lamb. That will have been subdued. It will have been crushed, totally crushed by this time. Yet some people will still want to adhere to the shackles of that religion, and we're told that they will be punished with the same plague of destruction that we read about in Zechariah 14 and verse 12. That would be their ultimate fate. But what about Egypt? Do you really think Egypt will be like that, that the family of Egypt will not go up? It doesn't seem to fit. I believe that Egypt here, and in these two or three verses, 17, 18, 19, is really a symbolical term for the spiritual darkness that will still be around in the minds of some people. They'll still be holding on to things like Roman Catholicism, the spiritual darkness of that type of religion. And we know that Egypt will be different in those days. The children, the people of Egypt, the people of Iraq, the people of Israel, we're told that they'll be faithful people in those days. Looking at Isaiah chapter 19, verses 23 to 25. "In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Israel, at least Assyria, the work of mine hands, and Israel, mine inheritance." So in Zechariah 14, it seems that Egypt is probably a symbol for spiritual darkness of those who would still hold on to false religion, despite the wonders of the kingdom age. Well, this brings us to the last couple of verses of Zechariah 14. Now, these verses are still dealing with worship in the kingdom age. Curiously, the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Ingathering, is a feast which is full of sacrifice of numerous animals. You'd think it would be all to do with vegetables and grain and corn and stuff like that. But it's got to do with animal sacrifice, including bulls and rams and lambs and goats. If you were to glance through Numbers chapter 29, verses 12 to 34, we have no time to look at it tonight, and there's a companion verse in Leviticus 23 and verse 34, but in Numbers 29 in particular, at the top of my Bible it reads, "The offerings of the Feast of Tabernacles." And then it goes into all these animals, the bulls and the goats and the rams and the lambs. And that's what it's all about. The Feast of Tabernacles is all about sacrifice. Now, to officiate at this feast, God has arranged for mortal priests from the nation of Israel to greet mortal visitors. And the animals to be offered in sacrifice by those visitors will be prepared and processed as directed by the mortal priests from the nation of Israel. A portion of each of the sacrifices will be eaten by the worshiping mortal, and the fat and the blood will be conveyed to the altar of burnt offering by the immortal priest or immortal priests. And you would be one of those immortal priests. And the process is all very carefully outlined for us in the 40th to the 48th chapter of Ezekiel. In fact, the duties of the mortal and immortal priests are separate, but they are specifically outlined for us in Ezekiel 44, verses 10 to 31. And if you'd like to do that, it's for homework. You can look at all of those verses. But we have a picture here of the temple city, which I'd like you to have a look at now. This is the temple city of Jerusalem, and we're going to be dealing with that little verse, the pots and bowls before the altar. So let's just read about those. I don't think we read this yet. Verse 20 of Zechariah 14. In that day there shall be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord. And the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. So what about these pots and bowls? Well, let's just examine this picture for a minute. You could say that the outer part of this square is the city of Jerusalem, and the inner circle is the temple. Therefore, so we have a temple city of Jerusalem. And then in the center of the temple, we have the altar of burnt offering, and we have an ascent up to it, which is ascended by the immortal priests. And around the inside of the temple, we have the altar of wood, or it is also described as a table before the Lord in Ezekiel. So that altar of burnt offering is accessible only to immortal priests because it's in the center of the most holy place, a very vast, holy, most holy place of some half a square mile in size, as you see on that plan. Now, this altar of wood may look something like that. That's a cross-section of the altar of wood. And the offering arrives having been conveyed by this altar of wood. It arrives at the ascent, and then it's taken up to the altar of burnt offering. So this altar of wood, or this table before the Lord, appears to be a circular trough-like conveyor, having a circumference of some 2.5 miles, and it's shown in blue on the picture. And the offering being made would be placed into these golden bowls, and then it would be floated by a conveyor to this point before it's taken up to the altar of burnt offering. So there's a sequence of events. The person worshiping at the temple arrives with his offering. And the mortal priest receives the offering and prepares it and arranges for the slaughter of it. And then a portion of the meat is taken to the corner courts, which are called boiling places or kitchens, because a portion of the offering will be eaten by the person offering the sacrifice. Now, the portion that is offered to God is carried by the mortal priests into the temple and is handed to the immortal priests, who place it into the altar of wood so it can be conveyed to the appropriate spot to be taken to the altar of burnt offering. And when it gets there, when it gets to the altar of burnt offering and is being burnt upon that altar, the portion that was prepared for the offerer will be eaten. So you can imagine the offering will be burning on the altar, and the person worshiping will be eating a portion of the sacrifice himself. So this is a fellowship in the kingdom age for those who are involved in this process. And it seems logical that the adult members of the families arriving for worship will all be in the truth. And the Feast of Tabernacles is a feast of fellowship, having the same purpose as we have today in the bread and the wine service. Both serve as a memorial of Christ, who was a perfect sacrifice for sin. Now, under Mosaic law, all the animal sacrifices pointed forward to the work that Christ accomplished in his death. That's what they did. They pointed forward. Now, in the kingdom age, animal sacrifices are not just the Feast of Tabernacles, but all of the sacrifices, because there are several others. They will look back upon what great work the Lord Jesus Christ accomplished in his death. So that is dealing with the process of worship. But Zechariah ends with an observation that false worship will be forbidden in the kingdom age. And you notice what it says in the last few lines of this prophecy: there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord. No more. The Canaanite, well, what a Canaanite is, a peddler or a false teacher. That's what a Canaanite is. One who has habitually made merchandise of gullible hearers for generations. And Revelation 18 verse 11 says, no one will buy the merchandise of those false teachers anymore, because such false teaching will not be allowed. Well, in conclusion, we don't have time to summarize the 14 chapters of Zechariah, so we'll not attempt to do that. But we should remember that Zechariah was a prophet and he was a priest. And in his life, he succeeded in getting the Jews of his day back on track, back to doing God's work in the year 520 BC. And through his urging, the temple of Zerubbabel was built and finished in 516 BC. Ezekiel describes a magnificent temple of the future. And tonight, we have read that what Zechariah says about the use of that temple. He has written things concerning the kingdom age, and he's actually taken us right into the atmosphere of that age. He's also succeeded in bringing our minds to focus on the Lord Jesus Christ through these sacrifices, because Jesus Christ was the Lamb of God which taketh away the sin of the world. And by doing that, he has shown that he has a mark of a true prophet of God. Thank you.